Committee to order. We do not yet have a quorum, but we will certainly announce that when that happens. I am sensitive to our time and want to be respectful of people who have made the effort to be here for the meeting, as well as the time of our members. We're making an effort to try to stay on track if we can. And I apologize. I guess the committee preceding ours ran a little late, and that meant that there was some delay in getting the transitions affected here, so we apologize for that. This morning, what we are hoping to do is hear from some people who have direct participation in our long-term care programs in Minnesota. We are doing a overview, if you will, for the committee purposes to understand the components of the HHS budget. A significant part of that has to do with long-term care. So we have invited people here to give us their perspective. The ceiling stays intact. Appreciate your willingness to be here and help the committee in its understanding. So I would like to first invite Bob Meyer from the Department of Fiscal Analysis and Performance Management of the Department of Human Services, if you would come forward, please. And thank you for coming by this morning, and I will turn it over to you. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Bob Meyer, Continuing Care Administration, Department of Human Services. Actually, I will be going. In your packets, you should have a document that has a series of pie charts. Looks something like this. And I'll be walking through that document with you. This is a very similar presentation we did in the House about a week ago or so. And the idea behind this presentation is to take you from the global Medicaid budget down to long-term care, then to describe the various programs that consist of long-term care and a bit how they work. And so that's kind of what the purpose of this presentation is. In state fiscal year 2009, we spent about $7.2 billion in the Medicaid budget, and about 45% of that budget was spent on long-term care for disabled and elderly. Long-term care services typically consist of two components, long-term care facilities and waivers and home care. The other part of Medicaid is spent on basic care. That would be like payments to hospitals, physicians, drugs, and health plans. The thing to keep in mind here is all disabled and elderly recipients on the Medicaid program receive basic care as well. You just don't come to the Medicaid program and just get long-term care. You also get the basic care. And so of all the disabled, and we had about 106,000, I believe, in state fiscal year 09, about 42% of them received a long-term care benefit. And for elders, about 55,000, about 65% in state fiscal year 09 received a long-term care benefit. As you can see there, the primary reason elders typically access the Medicaid program is to access the long-term care benefit. They get admitted to a nursing home, their assets get diminished, and they become eligible for the Medicaid program. Of total long-term care spending, and just a note here, Mr. Chairman, we are talking here in terms of total dollars, and not state shares or county shares or whatever. And the reason for that is, as we put the charts together in that way, is we believe the committees can then see the true growth in the programs. Given some of the changes that have occurred with some of the federal stimulus monies and some of those kind of things, this gives you kind of a pretty easy way to figure out what the real growth of these programs are.
Mr. Meyer, just to clarify your point you just made, so what these charts are reflecting is what I've heard referred to as the all funds
correct
budget, and if my memory serves, in this particular area of medical assistance, about half the money is federal money. Is that about right? So what we see here is the total portion of the state and federal monies, for which is about 50-50 for
correct
rule of thumb.
So, and the only exception to the 50-50 share was the previous biennium.
When we had the,
we had the stimulus money.
The supplementary funds that were paying a portion of the state commitment to that. Very good. Thank you. You continue.
About 70% of our long-term care funds are spent on waivers and home care. And waivers and home care include programs like the DD waiver, the CADI waiver, the elderly waiver, our waiver for traumatic brain injury, our CAC waiver, and personal care and private duty nursing.
Mr. Meyer, let me interrupt you for 1 minute. We want to recognize for the record we do have a quorum. Thank you.
We also, waiver services purchased from health plans, primarily our elderly waiver program, has also been included as a home and community-based services in terms of these charts and estimates. Long-term care facilities will include programs like nursing homes, intermediate care facilities for the mentally retarded, as well as the MA portion of our regional treatment center costs when that's eligible for medical assistance. As you can see, over time, Minnesota has made a very deliberate move to maximize and to maximize the use of home and community-based programs wherever they could and use those programs in lieu of institutional placement. In the mid-1980s, there were moratoriums placed on both nursing home and ICFMR development. Those moratoriums, in essence, were trying to shift gears from relying predominantly on institutional services to meet our long-term care needs and to shift that to using home and community-based services. I'm now going to go to page 2. And we are now going to be just talking about, for a moment, waivers and home care spending. Most of our waiver and home care spending is spent on services to persons with disabilities. Those services would include, like, the DD waiver, our personal care attendant program, and our CADI waiver program. Again, we added, for the sake of the elderly, our alternative care program, which is a state-funded, program that somewhat mirrors our elderly waiver program. So in any case, most of the monies in our home and community-based picture are directed toward persons with disabilities. Again, this is part of the reason that that piece of pie is quite large is we use many of these programs to deinstitutionalize individuals from state regional treatment centers, as well as in some cases we have downsized many of our community institutions and they have come into those waiver programs. So we have converted quite a bit of institutional activity in our area of developmental disabilities. In terms of facilities, about 80% of our long-term care facility funding is spent on nursing homes. And the other aspect of that is we also have about 2,000 community-based ICFMR beds that we continue to fund as well. But most of the long-term care spending that we have is spent on nursing homes. Just moving to page 3. Overall, our long-term care spending is expected to increase at an average rate of 5 to about 5.7% per year if we look from 09 to 15. This, too, again, is in terms of that total cost that we talked about earlier. I believe Mr. Hoffman's figure was about 5% in some of the materials that he presented. It's important to look at the long-term care spending. You need to, in terms of both sides of it, there continues to be people moving from institutions to home and community-based services. And so we look at the net change. So the 5.7% is the net change in long-term care. About half the cost increases are driven by caseload increases, and the other half is driven by average cost per person increases. Average cost per person increases are consist of increased service needs of the individuals, increased use of more costly waivered services, average days of services, and rebate, you know, and rate changes that may occur in the area of long-term care. Rebasing nursing home rates would be an example.
Mr. Meyer, can I stop you for 1 minute just for some clarification? Your comment about increased use of more costly waivered services, are you saying that the waivered services are more costly than the other kinds of services, or that waivered services that were at one level of cost have become more costly? Can you clarify that?
Mr. Chairman, more of the latter. What we're referring to there is that they are not becoming more costly in institutional services, but that they're a more expensive in terms of the waivered service package itself. For example, as soon as somebody's being served at home, they're roughly half the cost, than if they were in an assisted living program. Or if they were in a corporate foster care environment, they're roughly half the cost were than when we were to serve them at home. So as you get more people sometimes accessing those more expensive waivered service arrangements, then that moves the cost per person in that program.
Okay. Thank you.
In terms of caseloads are expected to grow at an average annual rate of 2.7% a year. Again, this, as you know, in our long-term care facilities, you'll actually see the caseloads going down typically about 2 or 3% a year. And those individuals typically, or that capacity, again, is picked up in the growth of the home and community-based programs. And our growth in home and community-based programs in terms of caseload has been about 4% a year. But I think I should keep in mind that there's been a series, in many cases, of enrollment limits and enrollment caps for those waiver programs that does affect caseload growth. And so the factors that affect caseload change include not only the demand, some of the waiver programs have considerable waiting lists, like the DD waiver program has a waiting list of 3,000 or 4,000 individuals. But also there's factors like in, I believe it's 2014, you'll see the slope of the line move a bit downward, and that is really implementing a level of care change that passed in the 2009 legislature but got delayed out to January 2014. And you'll see the slope of that line come down a bit, because it in essence means that when we raise the medical necessity criteria to access the program, fewer people qualified. So the caseload actually would be going down.
Now, Mr. Meyer, can I ask you a question just about, I guess about that indirectly, but could you, or do you know what percentage of the eligible population, I guess, there's a certain population that might be eligible for long-term care or waivers or home care. Some are doing that and others are not, just because their health doesn't require it. And so my question is just how big is the universe that we're talking about that is taking advantage of these kinds of services as a percentage of the total
Elderly, for example.
Yes, my question is imprecise because I'm not quite sure how to define those categories. But do you get the drift of what I'm trying to get at here? What portion of the population is being served? I guess of the population that might be served.
Mr. Chairman, that's a good question. I don't have the answer to that one right now, and we could certainly put something together.
I appreciate if you'd give that some thought and maybe give us a little bit of an idea, because part of this, in my opinion, is also understanding what the future is. You're talking about changing eligibility, so and that may play into this, right. But it would be helpful to have some understanding of what the future growth of this might look like.
And, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I do recall when we were doing some of the analysis around the effect of those changes in the area of the elderly waiver program, we believe, based on the criteria, about 12%, 10 to 12% of those individuals would not be eligible for that for the EW waiver program as a result of implementing those level of care changes. So I was trying to give you an idea, at least in the context of that change.
Thank you. Senator Sherrin, did you have a question?
Yeah, just to follow up on that, or if we put a cap on these waivers or we change eligibility requirements because they have to meet more daily living requirements or whatever the criteria is to access the waiver, you're talking about that 10 or 12% that would no longer be eligible for the waiver, or if there were not enough waivers. What happens to that group of people in terms of their service provision?
Mr. Meyer.
Mr. Chairman, Senator, a variety of things could happen. For a few cases, since accessing the long-term care benefit for the elder also became their way to access the basic care benefit, some of those individuals would be losing both their basic care and long-term care benefit. What we had proposed, what the legislature adopted, was that at least some long-term care benefit continue for them. It was a much smaller state benefit. Some of a smaller grant would be given to them as they lost entire eligibility in terms of both basic care and long-term care. Many of the elders, however, continue to be eligible for medical assistance, and many of them continue to be covered by health plans. So in some cases, we did figure there would be some offsets, that they would be accessing personal care or some home health care services, not to the extent that they were getting on the waiver, but that they would be getting at least some continued long-term care benefit as a result of the change.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, what I'd like to do is go to the second handout. This is actually more of the program-by-program description. It's called Summary of Home and Community-Based Waivers, Long-Term Care Facilities, Home Care Funding, and Eligibility. And what I'd like to do is kind of walk through this, kind of highlight some differences for you. The first sheet actually covers the home and community-based waiver programs for persons with disabilities. I'll start out with the top. Along the left-hand side, you'll see the waiver program, and along the top, we talk about the person served, spending, funding sources, how the funding is managed in those programs, and the basic eligibility for services. In terms of the Community Alternative Care CAC program, this is a program that serves primarily youngsters and young adults. They are very medically fragile and have very complex medical needs. This is a waiver. Had not we provided these supports, many of these people continued in hospitals and continued extended stay in hospitals. This is actually a small program, but the services for these individuals are very expensive. For the most part, most of these individuals are served at home. And in many cases, most of them require 24-hour private duty nursing. The second program is called Community Alternatives for Disabled Individuals, and that's a CADI program. This has been one of our faster-growing waiver programs. It predominantly, about 90% of the individuals served on this program are adults. We have been starting to serve some more, some youngsters in this program as well. Much of the growth of this program has been for persons that have serious and persistent mental illness, as well as physical disabilities. About two-thirds of these individuals continue to be served at home. And for the most part, this program has been pretty effective at converting or diverting individuals from regional treatment centers and nursing homes. More recently, though, we've been attempting to try to do some conversions, in other words, move people out of nursing homes into some of these home and community-based programs. This is one of those programs, for example, that has an effect, for example, when we try to make alternatives for individuals in Anoka, for example. Many of them will rely on these types of ongoing supports. Developmental disabilities waiver. For the most part, this is our biggest waiver program. And in many cases, part of the reason for that is that we no longer have state regional treatment centers for people with developmental disabilities. We used to have 7 regional treatment centers that used to serve people with developmental disabilities. Those regional treatment centers have closed as a result of bringing this program up, and the individuals then have shifted to this program. This program started out primarily as a conversion program. In other words, it was primarily converting institutional capacity to home and community-based capacity. Again, about 90% of the individuals on this program are adults, but this is a program that is starting to change. As we have turnover in this program, many of those older adults now are being replaced with young families. And so this is a program that is starting to change in terms of who it's serving. Traumatic brain injury program, mostly a conversion program as well, but has 2 levels of care. Here we have neurobehavioral, which is a hospital level of care, as well as a specialized nursing home level of care. Predominantly, mostly adults. About 95% of the individuals served in this program as adults. And in terms of funding, on these programs, typically these programs are funded, and we use typically county agencies, and we actually create funding pools for these county agencies based on per capita spending for these individuals. And as an individual may access the program, there's a certain amount of money assigned to that county pool to care for that individuals. And counties manage those pools of money to help achieve state objectives. The Developmental Disability Program has its own allocation, and CAC, CADI, and TBI program has its own allocation. But in essence, most of decisions made are local decisions. Who's making decisions about who goes on these programs or not are predominantly, those are made locally. And there are state criteria that local agencies must consider when those decisions are made. For example, whenever we put enrollment limits on waiver programs, decisions are going to have to be made about who goes on. There's state criteria that we've established for that, and then local agencies and the staff of local agencies then make those decisions with the families. Page 2 of the document, we are now talks a bit more about aging and elderly. About 90% of our elderly waiver is now managed through health plans. One of the major things about this program is that in attempt to integrate both the basic and long-term care services, health plans have taken over a bigger and bigger share of this particular program, and it's funded in that respect. One of the things that we see in this program is more and more of the people come to this program and they're already in customized living or assisted living arrangements. They've already been placed outside their homes. And so we've been trying to get a bit more upstream on some of these programs so that we have more options in terms of services. In terms of the alternative care program, the alternative care program is not federally funded, it's state funded, but it's an attempt of the state to get a bit more upstream by providing supports earlier that hopefully we can avoid some of the more expensive or the reliance on more expensive arrangements and choices downstream. And so it was a way of, in essence, extending the types of benefits you get on the elderly waiver. Nursing home, we're now, bottom of page two starts getting into nursing homes. In terms of nursing facilities, and I know there's a specific presentation that will be done after mine, specifically about nursing homes, but about 58% of the funding nursing homes get is a Medicaid. Historically, Minnesota had a very rapid growth of nursing homes in the 70s and the 80s. About the mid-80s, we put a moratorium on nursing home development simply because it wasn't sustainable back then as a way of providing for long-term care needs of people in the future. So we put a moratorium on nursing homes at that point, and actually the number of nursing home beds that we've been using has been going down by about 3 or 4% a year. Nursing homes have been changing their businesses from predominantly from a long-term to a short-term care orientation, and when they do that, actually the Medicare benefit from the federal government picks up much of that money, much of the revenues related to short-term care. Page three, ICFMRs. Again, these are an ICFMRs is a little different because about 92% of the revenues for these programs is Medicaid. Medicare does not pay for ICFMRs as a benefit. We roughly serve roughly about 2,000 people a year. We have about 200 facilities, and the average cost per resident here would be about $213 a day. And again, the caseload, like in the nursing homes, continues to decline as individuals make choices about whether they want to stay in the institution or go to a home and community-based service. The following three areas are what we call our home care program. They consist of home health care agency services. Predominantly, those would be skilled visits and home health care aid services. We have personal care assistance. That's our largest home care program, not counting waivers. It's our largest home care program. But it also serves quite a variety of individuals. It serves quite a few youngsters, and it also serves adults with physical disabilities, and it also serves individuals that have persistent and serious mental illness as well. So there's a wide variety of individuals served in that personal care program. Some of these individuals have also very significant needs as well. About 25% of the recipients that get PCA services also get waivered services. So the PCA program is a state benefit that in many cases, serves individuals, but some of those individuals are also on the waiver program. One of the federal requirements is that we have to exhaust our state plan benefit before they become eligible for additional waivered services. So in some of our waivers, we have what we call extended PCA services as well. And then we have private duty nursing, and we have about 500 individuals receiving private duty nursing. And this group, again, has very complex medical needs and would be very aligned with the group that we have in that CAC waiver that we mentioned earlier. So, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, that concludes my presentation. Open to any questions the committee might have.
Thank you, Mr. Meyer. Are there any questions? Okay. We have next on the agenda Todd Bergstrom from Care Providers of Minnesota.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much. Please state your name for the record.
Okay. Mr. Chair, members, my name is Jennifer McNerney, and I'm with Aging Services of Minnesota. Thank you for the opportunity to speak today. With me is Jeff Bostic, who is the Director of Data and Financial Policy with Aging Services of Minnesota, as well as Todd Bergstrom, Director of Data and Research for Care Providers of Minnesota. We're going to present to you as a group together today.
Mr. Chair, Ms. McNerney, can you bring the microphone right up next to you, please, and talk into it? Closer. I know it's going to have to be.
How's that?
Keep going. Just bring it up close to you.
Is that better?
Yeah.
Okay. That amplified wonderfully, yes. Yeah.
Excuse me. My apologies. Our two organizations, Care Providers of Minnesota and Aging Services of Minnesota, are together known as the Long-Term Care Imperative. Together, we represent Minnesota's nursing homes, assisted living, and housing with services, home care agencies, adult day, and other providers of home and community-based services for older adults. And I'd like to thank Mr. Myers for his presentation earlier that reminds us all that long-term care is more than nursing homes, because as you can see, there's a lot more to us than just nursing homes. We are here today to present you with the economic contribution of older adult services to Minnesota, an overview of funding for nursing homes, and an overview of the elderly waiver program. We will also show how Minnesota is rebalancing its programs for older adults from institutions, in this case nursing homes, to care and community settings, in this case through the elderly waiver program. This rebalancing is more cost-effective to the state and meets consumers' need and desire for more options for care. Mr. Bostrick and Mr. Bergstrom will begin by discussing the economic impacts, nursing home funding, and utilization. Then I will discuss elderly waiver funding and utilization. Please don't hesitate to ask us any questions as we're going through the slides. I know this is complicated, and we'll be happy to help out any way we can as we move through. So over to the data guys.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Again, my name is Todd Bergstrom. And what I'm going to do for the next couple of slides is actually just kind of go over some of the larger trends that have occurred in the last 15 years or so in Minnesota as it pertains to nursing facilities, assisted living, and some of the state programs related to those. The first one, which we will revisit when we at the conclusion of the presentation, is just some estimates we did in terms of what would have happened had the elderly waiver program not been in place, and meaning if everyone who was on the elderly waiver program were in fact in a nursing home, what would be the additional costs to the state of Minnesota? And as you can see from that, for 2010, we estimate that black bar up there on the top of the chart is actually what those additional costs would be, which would be about $275 million a year state share if those on EW actually resided in nursing homes. So one of the things I want to point out, though, is if you go back 15 years, I brought this out of our library from the office, is the 1993 distribution of nursing home beds in Minnesota. And what's interesting about that is the discussion 15, 20 years ago was, I think as Mr. Meyer indicated, was we are heading down a course where there's going to be too many people who are going to need too many nursing home beds and we're not going to be able to afford it. And in fact, in that report in 1993, the Department of Health estimated that in the most probable projection, we would need 49,000 nursing home beds in 2000, 48,000 or about 49,000 in 2010, and then slightly under 48,000 in 2020. And in fact, what has happened is the exact opposite. Today, we have roughly about 32,000, 33,000 nursing home beds in Minnesota. And there's a couple of reasons why that has occurred. The first is beginning in the 1980s and 1990s, the private market for assisted living evolved, meaning consumers expressed their choices would be, and their choices were to go to a more community-based setting. The second is that the state of Minnesota began the elderly waiver program, which put consumers in more cost-effective and community-based settings. And finally, nursing homes responded by actually de-licensing and closing beds, either out of necessity or out of incentive. A couple of other things I just want to highlight before we move on to other kind of specific trends is first just the economic output of nursing facilities and assisted living and other residential settings, estimated currently to be about $6.7 billion annually. And the next slide again, indicates that in total there's over 109,000 jobs are supported by nursing facilities, assisted living, and other residential settings in Minnesota. So going back to kind of what I highlighted before, the reform efforts that have been underway for the last two decades in Minnesota, like I said, in the 1970s, 1980s, and even the early 90s, and nursing facilities were the predominant provider of long-term care in Minnesota. And in response to the limitations of nursing homes, consumers demanded new options such as assisted living and home care. And then early in the 1990s, Minnesota responded by developing an option called the Elderly Waiver Program, which provided consumer choice and more cost-effective kind of provision of services. The market and the state continue to rebalance services. And likewise, in 1997, the legislature also began a reform of nursing facility payment by adopting the rebasing of nursing facility payments. And so just some of those trends that continue on. This next slide is the percent of EW and alternative care expenditures as a percent of all elderly long-term care spending. And you can see that amount has climbed since 2002 considerably as the state rebalances its own expenditures. And then in terms of capacity, and if for some reason it looks like PowerPoint has dropped out this picture, but we've closed over 24% of the beds in since 1995 in Minnesota, nursing home beds. And what that means, and there's a map, but and I think it's probably in your handout, but there's been about 59 closures throughout Minnesota since 2000. And in the beginning, when you go back to 1999, 2000, when a lot of these closures occurred, they occurred predominantly in Hennepin and Ramsey County. The last 5 or 6 years, it's become more equitable, I suppose, for lack of a better word, throughout the state, meaning there's been a number of closures in specific rural counties and continued closures in the metropolitan area. And you can see this, you can see the map right there. One of the things, I think this slide actually probably gives you a better indication of what nursing facilities do today as opposed to 20 years ago. And what this is the nursing facility length of stay, or the decline of the nursing facility length of stay. And it says a number of things about what actually is occurring, what occurred 20 years ago and what occurs today in your typical nursing home. First of all, if you go back to 1990, you can see that your typical nursing home average length of stay for your typical nursing home resident was about 2 years. And you can see presently that number is now substantially under 1 year. And perhaps even more importantly, if you look at the median, meaning the typical, not the average, but for those at the middle. So currently, the median length of stay, I believe, is 28 days. And what that means is more than half of all the admissions to nursing homes, those clients actually stay less than 28 days, meaning nursing homes are more and more focused on the rehab and other services and short length of stay, and more people are staying less and less. And so they've reconfigured the services that they provide. And then just to compare to the average, at one point Minnesota was considered a highly overbedded nursing home state. With 12,000 closures over the last 10 or 15 years, you can see that we are becoming closer and closer to the national average. In fact, these numbers are from 2008. My guess is with our continued closure of nursing home beds, that we're probably getting very close to that national average. And now I'd like to turn it over to Mr. Bostic.
Thanks, Todd. My name's Jeff Bostic with Aging Services in Minnesota. For the next few minutes, I'm going to talk about background on nursing facilities, particularly how they're funded, how the rates are determined, and some of those topics. Starting out with what are the sources of payment for nursing facilities? Because this isn't always well understood. Medicaid is the predominant payer, at least in terms of the days. It used to be a little bit higher. It used to be up in the 60s, but in the most recent data, it paid for about 58% of the days in nursing homes in Minnesota. The second most significant payer is private resources. This is both the days that are paid for privately by individuals who just pay their bill, but there's also a significant amount of money that's contributed by the Medicaid population that is essentially their private resources. The way the long-term care benefit works is if you're eligible for benefits, you first have to commit most of your income to your services, and then Medicaid picks up the rest. So, primarily in this case, people's Social Security checks go towards their care before the Medicaid program pays for that. A third significant payer is the Medicare program, but Medicare does not cover as much nursing facility care as some people believe that it does. It's essentially limited to rehab stays of up to 100 days, and you're not necessarily guaranteed of getting 100 days. You basically get the rehab that you need, and then Medicare at that point no longer will cover your stay. You would then be, if you stayed in a nursing facility at that point, you'd then be paying privately or potentially be eligible for Medicaid. And another payer that's growing but isn't all that significant yet in terms of the number of days paid for is other payers, primarily long-term care insurance. And the next slide is going to break down both how these days are distributed by payer and also how it's changed in about 17 years, so over a significant period of time.
Mr. Bostic, can I interrupt you for 1 second before you continue? Just to go back to I wanted you to comment a little bit about, if you can, about long-term care insurance and just what has been the changes you've seen. Has that become an increasing part? Has it stayed constant? Has it diminished? Approximately what portion of the cost is covered by long-term insurance?
We believe that it's increasing a little bit. On the next slide, we have a breakdown of what are called other days on what's reported to the state. And you'll see that it goes from about $200,000 to about $780,000. Historically, that's been primarily long-term care insurance, but the $780,000, I know we can't really break it down, but we know it's not all long-term care insurance, so we don't know how much of that growth is long-term care insurance. The other factor that kind of interferes with this is the managed care programs, MSHO in particular, the Minnesota Senior Health Options. When a day is paid for by a health plan, it's technically still a Medicare or a Medicaid day because they're eligible for both programs, but a lot of the providers, when they report to the state, report it as an other day because it's paid by someone other than the federal or state government. So breaking down how many of those days are actually long-term care insurance as opposed to something else is difficult. But we do believe there's been some growth over the last few years. But as you can see, if you look at the $780,000 that are paid by other compared to the $6.5 million that are still paid by Medicaid, which is it's a significant drop, but it's still, a much, much larger piece at this point. And the same with private pay. There's been a drop. There's still about 3 million days each year that are paid fully out of pocket by the individual.
Okay.
On the next slide, we're going to talk a little bit about the Medicaid rates. Like I said, these cover 58% of the days, so they're a significant component of how facilities get paid. And just a little bit of background, we could go into extensive background and do an hour or an hour and a half on this topic, although I'm not sure why anyone would really want to know that that much about it.
We may invite you back for that. So,
But each nursing facility essentially has 36 different rates. So every nursing facility has their own rate set, but each of them are divided up into 36 rates, and it's based on the level of resident need. You sometimes might hear the phrase case mix. Depending on an individual's case mix, they get a different rate. Now, the case mix is going to be consistent because you're using a federally required assessment that puts you into a particular class. The case mix is going to be consistent wherever you go. You should end up in the same case mix based on that assessment. But the rate will be different for each home. So that's basically how need is cared for and what it means to, kind of have different rates between facilities. The assessment then is repeated quarterly, or if there's a significant health change, you would do it again, so that the rate continues to reflect what the person's actual needs are. And the other detail that we put on here, because sometimes this comes up, we primarily will talk about operating rates, which is the nursing, dietary, housekeeping, utilities. That's most of what people get paid. But there are a couple of additional components. You get paid for property, for the upkeep, and the cost of any projects like remodeling or replacement will be reflected in the rate. And then there's also what's called external fixed costs, which is a component of the rate that's essentially costs that are not controlled by the nursing facility. It pays for pre-admission screening, the surcharges on beds, the license fees, property taxes, and things of that nature.
And Mr. Bossa, can you tell us just generally what the makeup of the rate is? It's one-third, or is most of it operating component? Or
no, the operating component is 80%. Yeah, it's probably about 80, 10, and 10.
Thank you.
Yep. The next topic that we thought we'd bring up is rate equalization. We know that it's been an issue that's come up at times over the years, and certainly one that's a significant concern for providers. And we'll get into in some of the subsequent slides kind of why that's the case. But first of all, just so everyone understands, the policy that was adopted back in the 1970s is that the charge for private residents is limited to the rates that the Medicaid program pays. So that essentially means you've got, we talked about 58% of the days being paid by Medicaid. You've got the next most significant chunk is those private pay days. Those days are restricted to the Medicaid rate. So you have a government-controlled rate essentially for most of your days. There are some exceptions. If you have people can pay extra to be in private rooms, the Medicare program is not restricted by equalization. But a significant number, probably 80% or more, of the days in the nursing home are controlled by the Medicaid rate and then by extension by the equalization policy. And the primary reason that that's a concern is that when the Medicaid rates don't cover the provider costs of providing care, the equalization policy essentially forces you to accept a rate for privately paid days that also doesn't cover your costs. So it extends, it takes the underfunding of the Medicaid program and extends that underfunding to additional days.
Yes, Senator Berglund, sorry.
Mr. Chairman and Mr. Bostic, if the Medicaid rate doesn't cover your costs, who does cover the rest of the cost for the Medicaid patient that isn't covered by the state?
Mr. Bostic.
Mr. Chair, it depends within each facility on what your payer mix is. There are certainly some facilities where they're not covering their costs, and that's been an ongoing concern in terms of the viability of some nursing homes. In other cases, it would be the Medicare program in general has a margin that for most facilities. So the more Medicare days you have, you make up some there. And the other primary piece would be private rooms are not restricted by equalization. So to the extent that you have private pay people in private rooms, and there's also an option for Medicaid people to be in private rooms and get a little additional payment if it's judged by the state to be medically necessary. So those additional payments have to make up the underfunding of the Medicaid and private pay rates.
So,
Senator Berglund.
So, Mr. Chairman and Mr. Bostic, if we were to eliminate rate equalization, those facilities that are making up the difference with these other sources of revenue would keep these other sources of revenue, but for private pay patients, they would raise their private pay rates?
Mr. Bostic.
Mr. Chair, yes, they would have they would not lose, depending on how this was structured, obviously, but in some sort of phase-out or repeal of equalization, they would not lose any of the other options, so they would have an additional revenue potential depending on how many private pay residents they have and how much those people are, you know, willing to pay for the, you know, for the rooms that they have in that facility.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Berglund.
Mr. Bostic, just one last question then. So facilities that tend to have probably more Medicaid patients, don't have very many private pay patients, they would not necessarily benefit as much by a change in rate equalization. Is that correct?
Mr. Bostic.
Yes. I mean, the repeal of equalization would assist people who have more private pay residents more than facilities who don't.
Thank you. Senator Sheeran.
Just to follow up on that, if that rate equalization was removed, what assurances would we have then that this, that it means that a private pay person would be paying more for their room than people on these other public programs, that there wouldn't be a disparity in the care? And also, what's unique to the end of life is that in order to be eligible for public programs, they have to spend down their assets to be available for those. So, you know, passing things over to private pay would increase the utilization of people's assets and move them more quickly onto a public program. So those are two issues that I'm hoping you'll be willing to address as you're talking about. I know that the nursing homes are looking for this to, in order to make up their costs, but there's other consequences to it.
Mr. Bostic.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Yes, it's true that there would be some amount of spend down impact, and we've looked at how to mitigate that in some of our proposals so that it doesn't add additional costs to the state from people qualifying for Medicaid more quickly. And as far as the other point, the care is pretty consistent now throughout nursing homes, and I think that an argument could be made that additional revenue, whatever source it comes from, would improve the ability to provide care for everyone in the facility, whatever their payer source may be. It's been very difficult in the context of a rate freeze to provide wage increases for employees, and this a change in the equalization policy would allow some flexibility to access some additional revenue that would likely benefit everyone in the facility.
Mr. Bostic, I'm sorry.
Just
go ahead, Sarah.
It also might, how payments received drives certain actions, and if you remove rate equalization, it could drive an action that really markets towards a particular client in order to engage in being able to raise more revenue. So I think this is although I understand the environment that drives this in terms of the struggle that nursing homes have to pay for their employees in a reasonable way, I think this is a proposal that I think needs very, very serious consideration.
Mr. Bostic, you mentioned that this rate equalization policy was adopted in the early 70s, and is this standard practice around the country to have a rate equalization structure?
No, it's not. There are two states that have equalization. We're one of them. North Dakota is the other. And in a minute, I'm going to get into the differences between those two states in terms of their Medicaid payment systems and the Medicaid payment rates. And again, reinforcing why we see the extension of the Medicaid rate in Minnesota to the private pay days as a problem.
And Mr. Bostic, and I'm not trying to jump ahead in your presentation, but if I think the questions Senator Sheeran is asking are good ones, and to the extent that other states have experienced this, if there is experience from those states to that would provide commentary on what happens and what the effect of that is, to Senator Sheeran's point, would be helpful.
Okay.
Thank you.
And Senator Hand, to your data collection suggestion is, you know, the a piece of data that's within the state might be what happened to trying to encourage growth in the habilitative services in nursing homes because of the better reimbursement rate under Medicare as opposed to Medicaid. So how you're paid does drive how you're going to run your business.
Thank you. Mr. Bostic, you may continue.
Mr. Chairman?
I'm sorry, Senator Berglund.
I have a different area of questioning, but it has to do with payment, actually through the Medicaid program. We do hold our health plans now responsible for a certain number of days of nursing care for people that are in PMAP through the Medicaid program and are elderly. And I'm wondering how the nursing homes do in regard to those contracts, because the length of stay has been reduced. And so I would think that those contracts would be working out pretty lucratively for most nursing homes that are involved with those health plans.
Mr. Bostic.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Actually, I don't know. I'm obviously not privy to a lot of the details of the contract. My understanding, though, is on the Medicare side, similar to the Medicare program itself, the contracts with managed care are fairly lucrative on the Medicare side, because the Medicare program in general tends to have a margin for nursing facilities. On the people entering from the community and not accessing a Medicare benefit, which is a relatively small chunk of people, and it's limited to 180 days. In most cases, the contract just pays the Medicaid rate, and the provider providers I don't think have pushed on that, primarily because it is at this point such a small number of people. The primary way that people get on Medicaid for nursing facility services is they're in the nursing facility for a while paying privately, and then when their assets are spent down, they're eligible for Medicaid, and then they start accessing a Medicaid benefit. Those people never have days paid by the health plan, because the health plan is only responsible for people coming from the community to the facility. So the way that people convert to Medicaid nursing facility services has meant that the health plan role is very limited in paying for those services, even though there is this requirement or provision that says they're responsible for 180 days.
Thank you.
The next topic we want to take on, because it comes up now and then, is why nursing facility rates differ. And just to be clear, like I said, every facility has their own rate set, and every facility throughout the state then has their own distinct set of rates. So it could be two facilities within the same town that have significantly different rates. And obviously, as you know, if you look from one area of the state to another area of the state, you'll find rates that are quite a bit different. Historically, the rates were based on the cost of providing care. That system was kind of terminated in the 90s, but back when that system was in place, the variation in costs between region of the state and between providers within the same region of the state, led to differences in rates. And that system, in a sense, was basically locked in, because when we went to what's called APS, which is a phrase you may hear around nursing facility rates occasionally in the 90s, the rates then became the existing rate plus whatever adjustment was provided by the legislature each year, if an adjustment was provided. So those differences in rates kind of continue and go forward to the current time. And this is, we also want to talk about the Medicaid rate and how it compares to cost. This goes back to some extent to the equalization discussion, but it's a broader issue than just equalization. I mean, we would like to see the Medicaid rates cover the existing cost of providing care, because it would improve the viability and of nursing homes throughout the state. It would improve the ability to provide quality of care and not always be kind of scraping to do the best you can with the limited resources that are available. I said, we don't have data going back this far, but back when we were on a cost-based system, we would have been pretty close to having no gap between the average cost of care and the average rate, because the rate was determined based on the cost. We've been off of that system for about 15 years or so now, and in that time, a significant shortfall has developed. The most recent national study showed that it's about $24.70 a day. That's the difference between the average cost, if you look at the cost report, as reported to the state, and then if you look at the average rate that's paid to the facility. And it's the underfunding of the Medicaid for nursing facilities is an issue nationwide, because there's a gap of 1733 nationally. So that I point out, we're higher than the national average, and we're also one of only two states that has a rate equalization policy, the other being North Dakota. North Dakota's average rate, which is actually now higher than the average rate paid in Minnesota, even though I assume the cost of living in most of North Dakota, at least, is less than the cost of living in much of Minnesota, they're paying at a higher rate, and they're covering costs at essentially 100%. We're covering about 87% of costs with our Medicaid rate. I said we'd like to see some changes to the payment system to address the inadequacy of the current Medicaid rates. And the next slide is going to explain how we've attempted to do that. Back in 2007, the legislature passed a proposal to rebase the nursing facility rates. And when we use the phrase rebasing, what that essentially means is look at the cost of providing care and adjust the rates to reflect the cost of providing care. And so the gap that we talked about on the previous slide would go away over time if this were implemented. And the way it's implemented is basically to blend the current rate with a new rebased rate that's based on costs until you get all the way onto a new payment system. It was originally... It passed in 2007. We started in 2008 by doing 12% of the rate based on rebasing and the rest based on the current rate. It was to change a little bit over time and then eventually get to 100%. It was suspended for 4 years along with a rate freeze. So there's essentially no operating rate adjustment for nursing facilities from 2009 through 2012 under current law. But we would go back to rebasing under the current law starting in 2013 and still be completely rebased by 2015 if nothing changes in current law. And if there are no questions here, I'm going to turn over the rest of our time to Jen McNerney, who's going to talk about the elderly waiver program and how it's kind of serving to address the needs of some of the people who aren't in nursing homes but probably would have been, even 5-10 years ago.
Thank you, Mr. Bostic. Mr. Chair, members, Elderly Waiver is a home and community-based services waiver program for people age 65 and older who are eligible for medical assistance and require the level of medical care provided in a nursing home but choose to reside in the community. I'm going to emphasize again, they not only qualify for medical assistance, but they have to also qualify to need the level of care needed in a facility, so a nursing home. The covered services are services that help maintain independence and are supportive, including a skilled nurse, home health aide, homemaker, companion service, a personal care assistant, home-delivered meals, adult daycare, or services, I should say, excuse me, supplies and equipment, and home modification are just some of the different services covered. As you've heard earlier, about 90% of elderly waiver clients are in managed care. This is unique because this is the only waiver program that has managed care. The rest are fee-for-service. Lead agencies, including the counties and managed care organizations, assess the client and develop payment for clients in the home or assisted living. And I'm going to clarify this point. Legislative cuts in 2009 and 10 and other administrative actions have cut certain parts of the elderly waiver program by more than 10%. In 2009, there was an across-the-board cut to long-term care providers, not just elderly waiver, of 2.58%. In 2010, there was a 5% cut to a particular subset of elderly waiver called customized living. This is a package of services that is delivered mostly in assisted living, and those providers were cut an additional 5%. And then finally, there is a new rate-setting methodology that is for the components of the customized living services that has changed component rates and time that providers are paid to deliver these services. So overall, some of our members have seen about a 10% cut, if not more. The percentage of people who are receiving services under customized living and 24-hour customized living, that is, in assisted living or housing with services, has grown. In 2008, it was about 35% of people on elderly waiver were receiving services under customized living. Just to clarify, customized living and 24-hour customized living pays for the services, not for the housing portion. So if someone is living in assisted living and is on elderly waiver is not covering rent. That is paid for either through private means or through GRH, the Group Residential Housing Program. We often talk about how many people are in the community and how many people are in nursing homes. Oops. Looks like we're about to lose our presentation here. There's about 22,000 Minnesotans who are currently on elderly waiver, 18,000 who are in nursing homes paid for on medical assistance. And there actually is quite a difference, I apologize, in the amount of money that's spent. Right now, it's probably less than half of the cost of nursing homes. The average monthly client on elderly waiver is about half of the average monthly client on Medicaid in a nursing home. So it's a cost-effective, cost-savings way to support individuals in the community where they want to live, as opposed to in a facility like a nursing home. That would be the next slide that shows the difference in cost. And then the final slide, is one that we started off with, which shows the difference that the state of Minnesota would be paying today if we did not have that more cost-effective alternative to institutional care. And finally, the last slide is our contact information if you have any more questions or would like to contact us for any additional information.
Thank you.
Happy to take any questions.
Thank you for being here, and thank you for your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Nino.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just one question, going back to the slide on the elderly waiver and talking about the 10% reduction. I believe we talked about this in my office, but for the sake of the
Correct.
Committee, whenever we're talking about cuts, I always like to ask, are we talking about less of an increase or an actual reduction in dollars? Because sometimes that term is a little ambiguous down here.
Mm-hmm. Ms. McNerney.
Mr. Chair, Senator Nino, that's a very good question. This was actually a cut in the rate being paid to providers. So this wasn't a change in the inflationary rate or that we were expecting an additional amount and got a certain percentage less. This was actually a percent cut from the amount currently paid.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for being here this morning. We do have a couple other people that have asked to present some information to the committee, and I'd like to call on, I hope I pronounce your name correctly, Jane Akramowitz, I believe, and Michelle Kimball. And please, if you could identify yourselves and pronounce your name correctly for me, and tell us who you are for the tape, I'd appreciate it.
Good morning, Mr. Chair.
And could you bring the microphone close so that...
It's easier than trying to lean into it. You're right. Good morning, Mr. Chair and committee members. I'm Jane Okramovich, a retired educator from St. Mary's University in Winona, and I'm currently serving as a volunteer of the president for the Seniors and Workers for Quality Care. We are a coalition whose mission it is to improve the quality of long-term care for those who depend on it and those who provide it. For the past 10 years, we've been concerned with many of the same issues that the long-term care imperative illustrated in its presentation today. However, we want to look at the impact that these areas present on seniors and those with disabilities who utilize the services provided, as well as on the workers who valiantly labor to provide quality care under trying circumstances. I'm going to insert just a little bit of personal information here. As a senior citizen, I know all too well that health care costs are rapidly rising, and I wonder where I will find the care that I may need and can still afford. The choices will be limited in many areas because of availability, as we've heard, facilities closing and cutting the cost and the eligibility for programs such as elderly waiver and Medicaid. My savings will have been depleted by the health insurance premiums that keep increasing, but I can't let lapse in case I need that treatment. On top of this, of course, our biggest concern is we need a stable, trained workforce in the settings that our seniors utilize if we want to receive good care. We hope that at some point we'll look at an alliance between the Department of Employment and Economic Development, working with Department of Human Services and the Department of Health to create this much-needed workforce. This is an area that we know job opportunities are continuing to grow. There are data available on this economic impact of short-sighted long-term care funding, such as a series of issue briefs that was published in November of 2008 by the Paraprofessional Healthcare Institute. And these particular briefs may help the committee in making some of these deliberations. We understand that you're facing many difficult decisions this session, and we stand ready to help you offer some solutions when looking at this area. I want to thank you for this opportunity to address the committee for your commitment to try and establish a long-term care system that serves the needs of vulnerable adults and the people who care for them, and also for the very good questions that you had today. And now I'd like to turn it over to Michelle Kimball, who will address a few more concerns and will be glad to answer questions when she finishes.
Thank you. And Ms. Kimball, please identify yourself.
Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Michelle Kimball. I'm the director of AARP here in Minnesota, representing more than 650,000 AARP members throughout the state of Minnesota. I'm very pleased to be here today. Thank you. To protect our most vulnerable citizens, AARP strongly believes that our long-term care providers must be adequately paid. Our older loved ones, whether they reside in a nursing home or in the community, deserve the best quality care that we as a society can provide. Home and community-based services in particular are integral to helping older Minnesotans age with dignity. Reductions in home and community-based services could end up forcing older residents prematurely into expensive nursing home care, increasing long-term care costs to the state. On average, home and community-based services can provide care to three people for the cost of serving one individual in a nursing home. Proposed cuts in this area may save a dollar now, but will cost the state significantly more in the long run. Maintaining adequate funding for nursing homes and their staff is also vitally important. We currently have a staffing crisis in our nursing homes. Any rate cut to nursing facilities inevitably leads to a reduction in already low levels of staffing, which greatly influences the quality of care. The lack of adequate targeted reimbursement for long-term care providers over the years has resulted in lower wages for staff, a lack of health insurance, and therefore an inability to retain quality staff. Many disincentives exist for attracting workers in long-term care settings. These include relatively low wages, in many cases minimum to just above minimum wage, heavy physical labor, emotional demands of direct care, low staffing levels, which result in a high workloads, and sometimes even dangerous working conditions, inadequate career paths, and the lack of health care insurance for direct workers and their families. These jobs are incredibly important to Minnesota. Providing adequate funding and requiring adequate levels of trained staff is the only way to ensure that our loved ones receive quality care in nursing homes. We also strongly urge you to keep in mind those nursing home residents who pay their own way and avoid repealing the rate equalization law. Such a repeal would result in a significant shift, cost shift, to residents who pay for their own care out of pocket. This increased revenue gives no guarantee of an increase in care or an increase in properly trained staff. This is basically a targeted tax aimed at those who save their own money throughout their lives and now pay for their own care. Not only would such a shift cost many Minnesotans thousands of dollars more, but it could also cost the state more and actually exacerbate the fiscal crisis that you and your colleagues are currently grappling to fix. Increasing the daily rate for private pay residents means they spend down faster and they become eligible for medical assistance much sooner. A fiscal note completed in March of 2006 to address House File 2826, a proposal that actually eliminated rate equalization, estimated that the repeal of rate equalization would result in a cost to the state in 2009 of roughly $9.1 million. This assumed that the rate increase was only 5%. AARP urges you to refrain from repealing rate equalization and instead find a balanced approach to the budget that allows us to maintain funding until we can address the bigger, more systemic problems within our long-term care system through comprehensive long-term care reform. A recent report in 2010 to the Minnesota Legislature by the Minnesota Department of Human Services entitled Status of Long-Term Care in Minnesota 2010 outline the statistics. In Minnesota, between 2010 and 2020, the population of those over the age of 65 is expected to increase by 40%, while those under the age of 65 will actually only increase by 4%. Minnesota ranks second among states in life expectancy at birth, 78.82 years. Add to that a net increase in those over the age of 85 returning back to Minnesota after spending their younger retirement years in other states, and you have an increasing number of the oldest old, many of whom will eventually need some sort of long-term care services. Over two-thirds of persons age 85 and older have at least one disability, and in fact are more likely to have multiple disabilities, which can often create barriers to living independently. So as you can see, there is an urgent need to address long-term care funding, both public and private, and reforming the system so that Minnesota can better prepare for this aging demographic. Any further reductions will result in reductions in workforce and thus a reduction in quality, and just at a time when the need for long-term care is growing. Thank you again, Mr. Chair, for the opportunity to speak here today, and I would be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Kimball and Ms. Ockram-Molwitz. I apologize again for stumbling on your name. I appreciate your being here today. And Ms. Kimball, just a brief question. I know we're getting close to our allotted time here, but your comment about the rate equalization and the idea that some may advance that we should repeal that. And you spoke in opposition to that idea, but could you comment on what the experience of the other states has been? It seems as if we are sort of the outlier here with, along with North Dakota. Other states, 48 of the other states, do not have this provision. Have they experienced the kind of, difficulty that you are projecting would occur? Has that been the case in other places? And if so, why have they not adopted equalization then to remedy that?
Yes, in fact, there have been issues in other states. I will note that of the two states in this country that have rate equalization, we have some of the highest quality of care in this country. In states without rate equalization, and I would be happy to provide this documented evidence to the chair, there is extremely high costs, anywhere from $200 a day for private pay residents to more than $500 a day for private pay residents. That would be in Alaska, actually. And in many states, there is a significant difference in the quality of care. One of the results of not having rate equalization, which we would fear here in Minnesota, is the growth of facilities that only seek to provide care to private pay residents. And then you have facilities that are simply only Medicaid residents. And we have seen, there is anecdotal evidence, there are stories that we have heard of individuals, and there's one in particular that I will note that's close to home, individual in a private pay nursing home in the state of Wisconsin who was private pay until she could pay no more. She then went on to the Medicaid program, had an incident, was forced to go to a hospital for that incident, was in the hospital 24 hours when she went to go back to the nursing home where she was staying. They told her there was no bed available for her, and she was there then forced into a Medicaid residency where the quality of care was significantly less than what she was being provided in the place that she had known as home for several years. And she died in that facility, depressed and very unhappy. But that is one anecdotal evidence. It's an issue that we fear. The biggest issue has to do with costs. We're talking about people who have saved their entire lives, want to do the right thing, and they're paying their own way in a nursing home, and they could spend down significantly faster and put themselves on the Medicaid program and raise the costs overall for the state. So I would urge senators to think carefully and look carefully at what the outcomes might be for the state should rate equalization be repealed. And I would be very happy to share the information that we have in writing with the chair and with the committee about the experience in other states.
Thank you. Senator Sheeran.
Thank you. I know our time is up, but as you're looking at data that you have, maybe you have this, I'd be interested to know what a modest increase in the Medicaid rate would be, which would allow an increase then in the private pay to offset that. What would achieve the same objective in a way that really demonstrated a broader tax base rather than targeting those who are private pay? If you have data about that, I'd appreciate seeing that as well.
Ms. Kimball.
Mr. Chair, Senator, yes, we do have information about that, and we do believe that the basic issue here, the basic problem, is the low Medicaid rate that we do have here in the state of Minnesota. And if there is a way that we can increase that rate, we can certainly increase across the board the private pay rates, and that would help nursing home facilities with the struggle that they currently have. And I would be very happy to forward additional information regarding that.
Thank you. Any other questions? Members, we are going to adjourn here in a minute. Just a housekeeping note. I've been advised by our administrators that people who have things that they want to keep in their folders, there's a save portion to put things in that. Otherwise, we'll try to clean them out so they don't get too bulky. If there are things you want to take back to your office, that's fine, too. But if you could help us with that, I'd appreciate it. And at that, we will see you tomorrow, and we are adjourned. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.